Accession number 28624, reel 12.
You would need a policeman there. You know, they would be aware or more aware of who we were looking for. If you would be doing a roadblock, which we did a lot of, we would set up and enforce the roadblock, but you did need a policeman there, you know, who would be aware and more likely, as in Zanzibar, to recognize the individual you might be looking for, should he come that way.
So, when you did do these cordons, how often did you do them?
We did them on an as required basis, and you know, in the first half of Swaziland, and I think the operation lasted roughly 10 weeks. So, say for the first 5 or 6 weeks, we might be doing one or two a week as a platoon. And the other platoons would be doing the same number in different parts of our sector of Swaziland. But these would be alongside a coordinate search of a village if it was believed that someone that we were looking for or should be looking for was holed up in a village. Then and the police intelligence would tell us that, then we would do a coordinate search, which involved, it might be a battalion coordinate search if it was a large enough area, and we did a number of those, or it might be a company one, which meant that during the night you would move to and surround the target village or township. So that in the morning when the villagers woke up, they would find themselves surrounded, and then your search parties with an accompanying police member of the police force would go around the village and homesteads and look for whoever the target was. But no one could get in or out of the village once we were doing this. So we did a lot of coordinate searches alongside the roadblocks.
And were you very quiet when you were setting these up?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely, because if anyone got wind that you were there, heard you or saw you, which is why you had to do it at about 2 a.m. when, by and large, people are sleeping, and you had to do it very quietly. So your vehicles would drop you off at a point, say, 2 miles away, or whatever the suitable distance was, so that they were out of earshot, and then you would patrol, then you would, the company or the battalion would divide, and the two prongs would then meet, and the tail would remain, and so you were in position surrounded, and once you were in position, you just stayed there, but absolutely quiet as a mouse, until the morning when they woke up and the alarm would go off that they were surrounded, but you know, then you could be a little noisier, but there wasn't much to be noisy about. You were just there, and very cold too. I remember it was winter, and it was cold.
And whilst this was going on, were the men quite close to one another?
Yeah, yes, you know, you could never have a gap of, say, more than about 20 yards, 25 yards between each man. Something like that was the appropriate distance, so that if someone were going to make a dash to get out of the cordon, you know, it would be very difficult for them to get through a gap of as small as 20-25 yards. Two people converging on someone ought to be able to cut them off, particularly as you were armed anyway. So it was that sort of distance.
And do you think the people were frightened, you know, the locals, do you think they got frightened in occasions like this?
Yes, I think they did, because whether you like it or not, and you've got to remember that in these circumstances, 99% of the population just want to get on with their lives and aren't much interested in the political machinations of a few. And there's no doubt that it is an encroachment on their privacy and on their life. And if you wake up to find armed soldiers around your village, you must wonder what on earth is going to happen. You know, are they going to take us away? Are they going to shoot us? Are they? What's it all about? So they were frightened, but time deals with that, because they would then discover that if there was no one there that we wanted, we would just disappear, and you know, they were safe again. So they quickly came to know that we weren't looking for anyone other than a few miscreants.
And did any of them ever cause trouble? You know, any of, you know, did any object to having the army around their village or anything?
It might be, but I'm not aware of it, because once, as I said, a few weeks later, once we'd pretty well achieved what we'd set out to achieve, you get on with the good peacekeeping bit, and I think we were quite good at that. And you patrol around, you go through the villages, you stop, you share your rations with the kids, you leave the bars of chocolate behind, and that sort of thing. We organised football games, because wherever you go in the world, everyone wants to play football. We played against village teams. Whether they had a village team or not, we would organise them into a team and we'd play with them. So we got on famously with everyone, and whenever we went into a village, we'd make a point of asking where the head man was and going up and shaking his hands and explaining what we were doing and what we'd done and where we came from. And so we were based in Kenya. We actually came from Scotland. So we would do that, and we did become very friendly with them. So any fears they might have had certainly disappeared. To answer your question, whether objections were made, I dare say they were, but not to us on the ground, because, it's not very easy and perhaps not very sensible to complain to an armed soldier, you know, about what's going on. But perhaps the head men were making noises and objecting, you know, to the administration, but I wasn't aware of that.
And did you ever catch anyone, you know, when you were doing these cordon searches?
Yes, we did. There were people rounded up, and I remember my job one day as a platoon was to take a whole number of people who had been rounded up from a prison to a reporting centre. You know, I had to go along to the prison with the list of names I wanted, and take those fellows off for interview. Not by us, but not by the Gordons, but by skilled interviewers who knew what questions should be asked of these people. So yes, there were people rounded up.
And so did you walk them away, or were they in a vehicle?
No, I took my platoon. We went in two trucks, and the third truck was spare, and we got to the we had been told to be wary about the prison, because, you know, there was there would be sympathetic people in the prison, sympathetic to the cause of the people we'd rounded up, and this was true, and true of the staff as well, and whoever was in charge of the prison said he didn't think he could help me, he didn't know if those people were there, and so on, and the list, and I said, well, in that case I'll have to take you all, including your good self and all your staff, you're all coming. Oh well, and suddenly he didn't really want to do that. So he was able to provide me with the men I wanted. He did root them out and they came. But we had a caged vehicle, a special, not just an open street tunnel, it was a, you know, it would have been a police vehicle, a caged vehicle in which to put them, and we formed the escort and just drove them. It wasn't all that far, and delivered them to a reporting centre.
Okay, quite exciting. And you mentioned the cold as well. Did you have on your coat at night or anything?
No, not coats. We didn't amount to anything more than we didn't have combat jackets. I think we had jerseys, you know. It was just one more item of clothing, that was all. Yeah.
Okay. You also mentioned the roadblocks.
Yes.
Was there a lot of traffic in Swaziland?
No, there wasn't. So that was a pretty dull job, I have to say. There wasn't at all much traffic. There would be traffic coming in across the borders. These were often done at a border point, because, you know, if you thought someone, obviously if you were an individual who thought that people were looking for you, you know, and they were based in Swaziland, the best thing to do was to get out of Swaziland. So, and we couldn't go out with Swaziland. I mean, we couldn't go into South Africa. We had to stay where we were. But the border points were generally the roadblock, because people would cross in or cross out. But still they weren't busy. There wasn't a huge amount of traffic in Swaziland anyway, going out, and not a great deal of South African traffic coming in. I mean, there was some, but you know, you might go an hour without seeing a vehicle, or you might get a few, but not traffic as we know it.
So, was there, you know, did they use things like donkeys and that to transport their goods? Was that the type of traffic?
No, these were vehicles that, cars, trucks, buses, and we would just stop them and search them for whomsoever. No, they were cars by and large.
Okay, and did you have local police again?
Yes, oh absolutely, yeah. We would set up the block and hold the car and or the vehicle, and we would allow the policeman to search. He was therefore searching with a lot of security around him.
Okay. And how many men would you have on a roadblock?
That would we did everything in platoons, and you know, at any one time you probably don't need more than a section on duty, front of the block, behind the block, each side of it, actually on the block, so on. 8 men, say 10 maximum, so the others would be resting, and then 4 hours later, you know, you change, because this might go on for, you know, 2 days and 2 nights, something like that, so you probably 4 hours on, 8 off, or 2 hours on, 4 off, whatever arrangement you wanted to come to. But it would be a platoon roadblock with about 8 men on duty at any one time.
Okay. And whilst you were in the country as well, were you ever fired upon?
No, not at all.
So
absolutely not, no.
There was no threat, really?
At all.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Okay. I read that some of the mines was where the political unrest had started.
Yes.
Were you near any of those?
No, that was A Company. And, but they were always involved in precisely the same sort of thing as us, and they might have been doing it up in their area rather than as you know, we all had a sector until we acted as a battalion, and we had one or two battalion cordon searches, and you'd all come away from your sector and do whatever was necessary there, and then you'd go back to your path. But A Company, commanded by Derek Brown, was up there.
Okay. And you mentioned in the school, I think, that the headquarter company was there as well.
Headquarter company, yes. I'm not sure if they were in the school. I didn't think they were. They were close by, because it was a small town, as I say. I don't know if they were in a police barracks or something, but they weren't in school. The school was B Company.
So was it quite easy to stay in communications, you know, with the other sections, companies and that?
Apart from anything else, we didn't need radio for that, but we had radio, of course. But each company had a little office set up. Company headquarters, it was company commander, company second McCown, company sergeant major, and so on. And we had telephone now, just a normal landline, so could ring battalion headquarters, ring the other companies anytime we wanted.
No, so it wasn't a problem.
Not at all. Absolutely
okay.
Not.
Okay, so like if you had anything to report from your section, you could report and vice versa.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. You mentioned as well that on the second half of that period there, that it was more that you were going out and mixing with the people.
Absolutely, it was the old cocktail run. That's what it was. Yeah, which was much harder going than the first half, the operational bit. Yes, it was, and that, you know, the local social set are always very kind whenever the army's around, and they invite you to every party that you can imagine, and very tiring, but that's all part of the job.
What I was actually thinking of, which wasn't the cocktail party, was the photograph that you've given the museum.
The one with the pot of ale type thing when I was with the headman.
Yes, there was that one, and there was also the one with all the ladies. Was that in Swaziland as well?
Oh, yes. Yes, that was a very important occasion. The first one was just the peacekeeping patrolling I was talking about, that, you know, when the operation's over, and you go around and set up these games of football and just meet the people and chat to them about yourselves and themselves. And that was when the headman, who was a lovely chap who'd fought in the South African forces for the Allied troops alongside the Brits during the war, put on his old battle dress uniform and his medals, and brought out his pot of a sort of ale. It's a fruit mix, really, an alcoholic drink, and brought it out, and he and I shared a few sips out of that, and all very nicely done, and delightful people. The other one was the most unusual and exceptional ceremony, when the King of Swaziland, once a year, he takes a new wife, and on that occasion 1,000 maidens assemble at a given point, and from the early hours of the day they dance for him, which is rather more of a chant and stamping of feet. They don't move very much, but it's constant. You can hear the pounding and the music a long, long way away. And eventually he arrives and walks up the ranks of these maidens and makes his choice. And two or three of us had been asked to attend that, and we did, and had to keep our distance from. We couldn't go in uniform, of course, because that's a bit threatening, but we had, by that stage, had some kit sent down, so you could put a blazer and flannels on and went along, and that was terrific. But the Swazi warriors who surround the king, the young men do a form of national service there from about the age of 16 to 18. They're taken off all farming duties or whatever other work you might be doing in a village of the young men. And there they are, they're just the warriors. And they guard the kraal at by day and by night, and train as warriors, and carry their knob carriers and spears, and they kept an eye on us to make sure that we didn't muck about either with the king or the maidens. So that was a terrific ceremony to attend.
Was it quite impressive to
you? Oh yes, yeah, certainly was.
And the man, the head man in the village as well, was he quite proud of having served?
Yes, he was immensely proud, yes, and we went through each of his medals in turn. Oh yes, and his English was good, and he remembered in detail his service. Yeah.
And could a lot of the locals speak English?
Yes, yeah.
And
but, you know, though it wasn't a part of South Africa, it's actually in South Africa. I mean, Natal, the Orange Free State and so on, they're all around it. It's almost an island in South Africa. So, well, I know there they have their own dialects and languages, be it Zulu or whatever, but and the Swazis talk Swazi, but there's a whole lot of English spoken too. So yes, that was never a problem.
Okay. And when you were in these villages and things as well, were they in mud huts or was it like a proper?
No, it was very very poor state of homes. It was a sort of mud hut with thatched roofs, you know, grass sort of matting. I think thatch is a very good description of it, and mud walls and a hard baked mud floor would be inside. Yeah, very, very poor, you know, from a Westerner's point of view. With the cooking fire in the building, you know, in the middle of it all, and smoke all around it.
And you know, during the second half as well, did the Gordons ever have the pipe band?
Yeah. Oh yes, that's always a great treat for everyone to hear. Yes, the pipe band played, and people would come from far and wide to listen and watch that. Yes. And we had the usual football games and rugby matches and so on. There was time to do all that. And yeah, we had a big force down there because it was a battle group. You know, we had a lot of Rimi, a lot of Royal Corps Transport. We had engineers with us. You know, we were quite a large force. But the pipe band is always a great attraction, and they were released from duty so they could go around villages too. And that was very fun.
So how did you feel when it was time to leave, you know, in this 3 month period or however long it was?
Yeah, well, it's like everywhere, you know, it's like leaving Zanzibar. It is very, very sad because you make a lot of friends and you really do know that you won't be seeing them again. You won't be seeing the locals again, and you've made friends with them. By the locals, I mean, you know, the villagers, that sort of thing. You won't be seeing them again, and very good chance that you won't be seeing Zanzibar or Swaziland again. And in point of fact, I haven't been back to either of them. So you do know you're going probably for keeps, and it's always a very sad moment, because you genuinely do develop a fondness for the place, no matter how poor, fondness for it and for the people. Yeah? Very sad to leave them.
There was another question I just thought of, and that was, whilst you were there, you did say there was, you know, it was quite a large force down there.
Yeah.
Did that mean that you just had normal cooking arrangements? You know, you had the army cooks and everything with you.
Yes. The cooks are very much a part of our force anyway. Up in Gilgil, you know, the cooks there, army catering corps, they are under command and part of the battalion, so they flew down with us anyway from the outset. They then have to spread themselves out, you know, three might be allocated to each company or whatever, and some to battalion headquarters. So we had our cooks, and they set up their kitchens right away, so on, in the school, you know, under a tent or whatever, and they just get on with it, you know.
And did you eat there, or did you eat in the apartment?
Yeah, I ate there. Yeah, no cooking in the apartment at all. All meals down there.
Okay. And was it just the same way of transport of getting back? Was it just flying back?
Yes, from memory, exactly the same, just in reverse, yeah. And they died to me, refueled at Salisbury again, but I'm sure it was the same route back.
Okay, so once you did get back to Nairobi, was it back up to Gilgil?
Yep, absolutely, straight from the airport back to the old camp, and duties as normal, camp life resumed.
And the transport back, was that in these 3-ton trucks?
Yes, yeah. We're all called transport again, provided then they meet you at the airport. It's all very streamlined and well organised, and just like it, as though you've never been there.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Kinghorn.
Good morning.
The last time that I spoke to you, we were discussing when you were leaving Zanzibar in 1963. Swaziland.
Swaziland, yes, exactly, I remember.
I apologise, in 1963. Yeah. And where did you go after that?
That was, we were in Swaziland for just under 3 months, as I recall. So that would have been August 63, and we returned to our base camp in Gilgil in Kenya.
So, did you return to the same accommodation that you'd had before?
Exactly the same accommodation and exactly the same role. We were on standby for Kuwait, so we just took up where we left off, really, and our training reverted to precisely that role as opposed to this sort of internal security operation which we'd been conducting in Swaziland.
Okay. I've heard mention of Kuwait a few times. What was the threat there at the time?
Well, the threat then and now was simply that Kuwait is a tiny little a nation which is totally vulnerable because it's so small. And of course, it's hugely wealthy. And it has always been a potential target to predators, and we know for sure that one day it did come to pass and Saddam Hussein moved in. So nothing like that happened when we were in Kenya, but we were part of the East Africa Command Force that was there on standby in case it did happen. You know, but saying that, you're also on standby for anything else that arises. So, whilst we never went to Kuwait, we were able to do various things in Kenya. We did go to Zanzibar, we went to Swaziland.
And for Kuwait, who do you think was the threat there?
Hard for me to say, really, because as a mere soldier and in training all the time, you hardly get time to listen to a radio or read a newspaper, but you know, it would undoubtedly have been one of its neighbours, I imagine, which in time, you know, did invade.
Okay. And when you were back in Kenya as well, were you just doing exactly the same type of work as you've been doing earlier, you know, going exercises and training? And
Yes, we were. And that is largely because, you know, we had been away and doing something else in Swaziland, so you know that part of our training could conceivably become a little bit rusty. But you know, you train all the time to keep fit, and that's the essential part. You know, fitness training iron out the wrinkles in your field craft, and you know, a lot of live firing to make sure that you're on target the whole time. So we did revert to precisely what we had been doing before.
Okay. And you allowed the museum and the Imperial War Museum copies of your photographs, and one was of yourself on an exercise, I believe, with some aircraft.
Yeah, well, that's right. I remember that one. I had earlier in the tour of Kenya, I think
sometime in 1962, I would think, I had gone on a what's called a forward air controllers course, which